Thank you for the offer, and I'm definitely looking forward to presenting this material to you this evening. Guasta Vino is definitely one of my interests in architecture. Their work is it's a father-son team combination. Their work is very interesting, and their story is also very interesting. I won't get so much into their backstory tonight. I mentioned a little bit earlier today. I put in a proposal for a six-part lecture series on Guastavino's work that will cover not only his local Pittsburgh work that we're going to see here tonight, but also will cover some of the backstory back in Spain as well as in other cities around the United States, New York, Boston, for example. The father-son immigrated to the United States and. As they came over, they quickly swept the country. They built over 1,000 structures across the United States over their careers, and were fortunate enough in Pittsburgh to have about three dozen different structures. I'm going to get into about 20 of them tonight here, just to kind of give you a little bit of a sampling overview of their work. So let me share the screen here. And can you see Porter Hall? So what I'm going to do tonight, so the series that I proposed that hopefully if you find tonight interesting, you'll tune in for that later this year, will break his work down into various subcategories like architectural innovations, structural innovations, material innovations. Because one of the things that's interesting about Rafael Guastavino and his son, who was by the same name, Junior, the two of them were extremely innovative and creative, and you'll see that tonight in the work. And those innovations span multiple patents in various types of structural work and material sciences, as far as acoustics and lighting and things like this, insulation. And so this work can be found many of these innovations can be found here, right here in Pittsburgh, and we're going to kind of go through that. But the course is kind of broken down into those subgroups because that kind of works well on each week would be a topic, like the structural innovations, for example. Tonight I'm going to kind of present these chronologically, which is also an interesting kind of analysis of the work because you get to see in a chronological fashion, you get to see how the work develops. And as we go through it. So I'll start off here with Porter Hall, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with here on CMU's campus. This was his first work in Pittsburgh, and this was in 1905 in Porter Hall in particular, down in the central hall. The tile that's on the ceiling, which we're seeing here, was literally the first thing that the Guastavinos did in Pittsburgh, and this was by invitation. And having been familiar with some of his work with Hornbostel in elsewhere outside of Pittsburgh, who was working on this building, brought him in and introduced him to the Mellons. And so we see here in this vault here, really the signatures of Guastavino's structural clay tile vaults, these tiles here that we refer to these as tiles, they're actually very thin bricks, what Spanish style brick we would refer to. If we zoom in here a little bit closer, you can see that at the arch here, it's a layer of three layers of these thin bricks. And the bricks dimensioned are roughly about 6 inches wide by 12 inches long, and then about an inch thick. And so they would lay these flat and in multiple layers here for structural purposes, but then also If we zoom back out, in the field of the vaults, we have this herringbone pattern. And this herringbone pattern also is a signature trait of this Spanish style vaulting. And in addition to that, we also see, if we get in a little bit closer, you can see these striations in the surface of the tile. And this is, in the earlier tile, this was a texture that was applied to the surface of the tile because the tiles were primarily used for structural purposes. They weren't used for a finished decorative surface like we're seeing here. And so being structural tiles, they would be infills in between, and then there would be another finished surface that would be applied to the face of this. And so these striations would enable the mortar set or the cement that's bound between the tile as well as the finished material. It gives them more of a texture to bite to. And so initially that was the purpose of this, but then over time, these tiles, because once they were laid up, as you can see here, they become quite beautiful in the pattern, in even the way they catch the light, as you can see here, these being glazed on the face as opposed to a unglazed type finish that would be the structural tiles, a terracotta type finish. But eventually they were so beautiful, the first time that he used these tiles, which was on the Boston Library when he first came to the United States, when they went up, the architect for that building was so enamored with the visual of it, he asked if this could even be used as just a finish. And so over time, these structural tiles evolved into a finished tile surface. And that was part of the innovation, is that you lay this and it structurally supports this floor above, but at the same time, it also becomes your finished surface, so it's all in one. We move on here a year later to the Calvary Episcopal Church. We see here the same thing down in the basement, the tiles being used as a vault. And this here again is just strictly, in this case, a structural tile. You can see again the layers that are being laid up here in the corners. And the number of layers would just strictly be a function of how much weight they need to support. And in this case, the tiles are again just serving a structural purpose. They're not ornamental. And so you can see here on the face, you can see that these are the terracotta tiles. They're not glazed. They're painted over here just for protection purposes, but they're not intended to be a visual appeal. We see here on the drawings, they call out, they actually name Guastavino vaulting in the drawings. So they're actually specifying the architect when they put these drawings together, calling out this hatch pattern here where these tiles would be located down in the basement of the church, the main proper church here up above. And so if we move on here to, we see, again, in this drawing, calling out the Guastavino here in the vaulting up above, and we see that being the case here, the vaults coming in. And here again, these tiles are also not really meant to be visual, and so they're very rough and raw in their treatment. But at the same time, this was a side aisle off to the side, so it wasn't necessarily a place that needed the more decorative tiles. And then we see here again in the aisles, calling out for the tiles that we're seeing again here, laid up in a much more visual approach in these side chapels. And then one last case of it here at the Calvary at the corners here. And this is again another type of tile. This was something we found with Guastavino, is that the materials would change quite frequently, and so then it would render various different types of finishes as a result of that. And you can see here the modeling of this, just different colors that come through in the clay. We move on here to Rodof Shalom Synagogue. This was in 1906, the same year as the Calvary Episcopal Church. And this was a unique structure in that the domes here were a square in plan. You can see it spanning up to a central oculus here that's square as well, the opening at the top. And this was an innovation at the time, creating a dome that was four-sided. It had not been done before. Interestingly enough, the architect for this particular building had called for a steel structure for the interior dome, the interior face of the dome when we look at the section. And then the exterior had a concrete shell to as an exterior dome. And this is quite frequently done in these types of structures, to where they'd have actually two domes, an interior and exterior, one for keeping the weather off on the exterior, and then one on the interior for holding up the decorative finish. At the time that this drawing was put together, what's fascinating is that we have this sketch, or the synagogue has this sketch on tracing paper that was done by Guastavino that showed him proposing to the architect an alternative to the way that the structure could be built. And here you can see the three different layers of his structural tile that's being laid up. And if we follow up to the top of the dome, you can see where the layers build up, and then they support the edge here. This is the sidewall of that square oculus in the center. And so at the top of the dome, you can see that he's proposing that by substituting his structural clay tiles, you could forego the two domes, one steel interior and the concrete exterior. And so sure enough, this obviously was a cost savings, also a speed. The clay tile was much faster to erect. And you can see here in this construction photo, you can see the tiles going up. And then also an interior shot here. This is before a plaster finish was applied to the interior that we have today. This was an earlier shot, and you can see actually the tiles on the inside here. And we move on to Dottery Hall on CMU's campus. This is in 1908. And you can see here this bridge that's spanning between these two wings of the building, this exterior bridge. And this was the first, if we zoom in a little bit closer here, you can see on the underside of this bridge a vault, which has this herringbone pattern, which is the signature of Guastavino's vaults. And so you can see here the first case of a Guastavino bridge in Pittsburgh, exterior bridge. We move on down just a little bit down the street to what at the time was called Machinery Hall. And you can see on the exterior here, the herringbone is being used in a much more decorative fashion. It's being laid up in between the terracotta decorative tiles that we have here. We see the arch is laid up in just a standard brick. And then the decorative terracotta tiles that are in here on the ribs, and then the infill of Guastavino's clay tile herringbone here, as well as the vaults going to the openings. This was a very common practice, to where you'd have a mixing of these various trades. The terracottas would be done by another trade. Guastavino would be coming in and just doing his vault. And so you can see some of this detail work. Even in the corners, that's very ornamental terracotta. And you can see the joints here between them. So each one of these is a tile piece. Much later on in his career, Guastavino got into some of this ornamental work on his own. But at this time, he was just doing the tiles. And on the tiles, you can see also here on the side, again, it's just the raw terracotta. It's not a glazed finish. It's smooth. But you can see the joints between it. The mortar is squared off, and this was a development that happened around this time, so this kind of dates the material. And this is when he started to dress this up. Even though it's using a unfinished tile as a finish, he's making it clear that the intent, that this is a decorative finish in the way that he's squaring up his mortar joint and also raising it from the surface, so it's not smooth to the surface, it's protruding. And also, in doing so, it enables the architect in this case to accentuate the various materials. He's using this kind of raw semi-raw type terracotta to infill and to really showcase these tiles here, ornamental tiles, a little bit further. But at the same time, the terracotta is handled in a very decorative fashion. A few more shots of the ornament. You can see here a three-dimensional ornament of the around the sides here. And this brings us to Margaret Morrison in 1914, which is also the same time that Machinery Hall was put up. We see here on the outside of Morrison this structure here, this porch, which had a circular vault here, which is essentially a dome, a very shallow dome, which is also a signature of the Spanish style vault, is a very shallow vault as compared to like a Roman true circular vault that you might be familiar with. And this brings us then to Baker Hall, to come, which is really his signature piece on CMU's campus, and really in Pittsburgh, for that matter, in general. Baker Hall is a place where he did some innovations on the interior that we'll get to here, but on the exterior, before you enter the main entrance here on the to the you see the vaulting here again, the terracotta tile that we saw over at Machinery Hall. Get in a little bit closer, you can see the handling of the mortar joints are the same. They have the relief where they're raised, referred to as raised joints. You can also see the texturing in the tile, the clay tiles, which themselves. What's nice about this particular building is you get to see the raw edge in the corner up close, and so you can kind of see the way that these tiles were made. Here's a burn mark that shows up in this tile in the firing. And so at this time, which was in 1914, this Guastavino was going through a process where they were building their own kilns to make their own tiles. Prior to this, they were buying tiles from manufacturers around the country, Cincinnati, Boston, various places. But they got to a point where they realized if they supplied their own tiles, they could control the end product much better. And so this was what was the case. And so these tiles were coming out of their own factory up in Massachusetts. What's interesting though with Baker Hall is that if we look from the exterior here, some of you might be familiar with this building, this octagon shaped protrusion here is a stair hall that takes flights of stairs up in through the building. And this stair, what's interesting about a stair, if you imagine here in this drawing here, this is a four-sided, which is a little bit different than the octagon that we find in Baker, but the principles are the same in that the corners are really become the important part of the structure to anchor the staircase. So the staircase that we're going to see is a suspended stair to where it's anchored to the side walls and not anchored in the interior. So the interior is cantilevering out the interior of the stair. And so with it anchored just to the sides, the corners where the two sides come together is a strategic point, because at that corner, the very first brick laid can have two sides that are touching the wall. And so they can be cemented in on two sides. And so that gives you, and then from the corners, you work your way out with the brick in this vaulting fashion. And then you can see here on the right-hand side, he's taken this simple arched pattern where the arch is going up and vaulting to this corner, and then from that they stack another flight of stairs, vaulting up to this corner, and then from there vaulting up to the next corner. And by doing so, you get this three-sided staircase that works its way up to the next level. Here you see taking a little bit of liberty, rather than just a simple vault, he's pulling the corner down and creating what's considered a catenary curve, which is a little bit more structurally sound. We'll see in the next slide here, a similar fashion is taken with the staircase. And so here you see the stair working its way up, winding like a spiral winding stair, And in this case, the exterior, that if you recall, was an octagon. On the interior, the walls were rounded with a standard brick. And so this rounding enabled the brickwork then to work into these corners, become almost these elongated corners, so to speak, with this rounding fashion, to where the tile could then work its way much more cleanly up against the surface. And so here you see a cross section through the stair, and you can see these three layers of the terracotta bricks that are laid into the sidewall, cantilevering out. And this cantilevering out is supported by the spine of the spiral stair, working its way down from the top level down to the lower level, this continuous serpentine spine. And so this cantilevering out comes to that point, rests on that spine, as well as supporting the vertical side of the stair, and the horizontal then is supporting the steps themselves. So we see this being the case as it works its way up. Here you see the serpentine spine on the interior, and then also the rowlock of brick that's going down along the wall, and then the herringbone filling in between the two. At the spine, we can also see the exposing of the three layers of the tiles that are laid flat to create that spine. But what's interesting is, as we go up to the top and we work our way to the top of the stairs, we find that the vault also continues at the top on the ceiling to a point, creating a dome and also an oculus. And so here we have the only case in Pittsburgh of a Guastavino oculus, where we have an opening in the center here, and the dome is supporting this oval shape oculus. Quite spectacular. This brings us to Hamburg Hall, which was in 1916, a couple of years later, the entry here. We see this section that we were showing, where brings the vaults down to a point in those last couple slides. We're seeing an execution of that here, the herringbone pattern working its way down and fingering out from this tight corner. And so on the right-hand side, you can see that again, they work from this starting point down at the bottom, and they lay up these ribs, and they lay and then infill between them with the herringbone. And so each one of these tiles, as you can imagine, down here at the bottom, has plenty of surface area to attach to. And as they work their way up, they finger through on these herringbones, attaching each piece to the two below it, is the technique. This brings us down to downtown, to the City County Building downtown. And I show this. This is a slide from the construction. Is an interesting point here. You can see on the front of the building here, the three arches that form the entry to the City County Building. And you can see this scaffolding that's been laid up in an arch. And this is a true Roman arch, circular, pure circle form, not like the Spanish vaults that we've been looking at, with a much shallower profile. But what's interesting is that this Roman style arch requires this scaffolding, this temporary shoring of material to support these large pieces of stone that are being laid up here. You can see they sit on the scaffolding, and as you can familiar, you get to the top where you have a keystone that fits in, and once that keystone locks in, you can then remove the scaffolding below it, because the keystone bears all the weight of the two sides of this arch, leaning in and pressing on that keystone piece. The Spanish vault was a superior to this, in that it didn't need this structural support of this scaffolding, temporary scaffolding between. And so we see here on the interior, the vaulting that's spanning from these vaults that we just were looking at. These vaults were laid up in stone, so you can see here the scaffolding is gone, the stone is in place. And then from that stonework, and also from the stone ribs that are running in perpendicular to the ones on the front face, then they're infilled between with the brick vaulting. And this brick vaulting fills in between, and because of that locking together, puzzling together of the pieces that we were looking at in the Hamburg Hall, you get the ability of these tiles to be laid up one after another with a quick setting mortar to where you can reach across and you can span this dome without the need of scaffolding. So this was an advantage because you didn't have the cost of the scaffolding material as well as even the time for that matter to build it up and to lay across it. We see also here with these tiles at the City County Building examples of starting to work in decorative tiles, these triangular shapes. If we get in a little bit closer here, not just strictly the rectangular pieces that we're seeing down in here, but we're getting into some squares, triangulars, as well as irregular infill pieces. In addition to that, also striations in different colors of the glaze. He's doing a modeling here of a lighter and darker shades of blue and of beige. Zoom out here a little bit, and you can see from below the vaults here again that are filling in between the stone ribs that are structurally supporting the clay tiles. And that brings us to the Mellon Residence on Chatham University's campus. What used to be the Mellon back when it was the Mellon Residence, it used to be their pool room. They had an indoor pool, and this pool, this is the ceiling of the indoor pool. So you can imagine here where the floor is. This used to be a pool below it, and this tile was used on the interior here for several different reasons, but primarily the tile glazed tile surface was a surface that could handle the moisture and humidity that you get from an indoor pool. So this interior room had to be completely clad with a material that could handle that humidity. So you could see the tiles used here on the walls in addition to the vaults. Again, this is a signature Spanish style, very shallow vault. With the glazed tiles in the herringbone fashion. We get in a little bit closer, you can see here he's using the raised mortar joint as well. This is in 1917, so this is also in that time period that when many of the CMU projects were going up. But we also see the striations he's putting in the tiles. Here are these a clear intention of these being a decorative tile. They're also glazed in white to have much more reflective capability. And so they would catch, as you can see here, they catch the light and the shadow, which just accentuates the texture. On the ribs here, he's also doing a pattern here of what's called crazing. When the tile glaze is the way that it fires, it causes it to crack. And it's just a surface treatment. It's the tile itself is not cracking, but just the glaze is fracturing. Again, just a decorative kind of treatment, in contrast to the more textured surface. But the white color was significant because the whole intent of this through these windows was bring as much of the daylight in and reflect across the surface of this ceiling to draw the light into the space. And so we see here the tiles being used for quite a few various innovations in dealing with the humidity as well as the daylighting and various aspects. This brings us to the B'nai Israel Synagogue and a building also done by Hornbostel in 1924. And what's interesting about this building is that if you look at the roof, being a shallow dome, you might suspect this would be a Guastavino possible structure. But surprisingly enough, if we look at the drawings, you see that the dome is actually built of wood, wood structure, and then also with a on the exterior, and then a secondary wood structure as well on the interior, creating the interior finish. So again, this strategy of two domes. So then if we look a little bit closer, we look down in here on the front portico of the building, we see a call out and notation for Guastavino's tile. And sure enough, on the front, we see a barrel vault here in this case of his structural tile. And the tiles in this case of kind of an unusual laying where they're laid side to side in a soldier type fashion as opposed to the herringbone pattern. And this is probably lending to the fact that it's a barrel vault, a true barrel vault here. So that laying enables the tiles to be laid much easier than in a herringbone pattern. But also, nice thing about seeing this structure is you see these metal ties horizontally, structurally. And so a little bit of an indication here that, again, we have this the Roman style pure circular arch here in stone that's needing to be tied with metal here laterally because with a Roman vault, you have a tendency for the forces to push out laterally. And so you need to resist that either with a loading on the exterior, some type of buttressing of weight, or some type of tensile tie in steel or metal like this, or a combination of the two. And so we're seeing that here in this case. The traditional brickwork here at the top is being loaded on top of the vault, as well as the metal tie. And so that's really kind of doing the structural duty. And so in this case, the clay tile inside here also is structurally supporting the roof in itself, but it's doing more of a decorative fashion here, more so than a pure structural. We also see this mosaic here, which was not done by Guastavino, but this particular building has quite a bit of examples of some interesting work. A little bit closer up here, you can see the mosaic tile reflective glass laid upon the a standard brick backing that's starting to deteriorate here. This brings us to the Allegheny County Courthouse downtown, which is a quite a notable building in Pittsburgh. And what's interesting about this building is that we find, if we go around to the side here, you can see the entrances to the central court of the building. You can see a shallow vault, which is also an indication that this might be some of his work. And if we get in a little closer, sure enough, we find the herringbone pattern here. And then as we work our way into through the basement entrance into the building, we can see here multiple layers of the tiles. And you can see these being laid up in an arch across this opening. And these multiple layers is a true indication of the fact that this is carrying the loading of the building above it. The courthouse here is multiple levels, so there's quite a bit of load on it. And this is being brought down to the bottom here and then picked up with this arch. And so you can see how these tiles, which is really their primary innovation, is their structural capacity to be able to carry these loads. And then from these arches, we see the vault here spanning, infilling between them. As we go inside the lower basement here, you can see these arches are repeated in parallel as we work our way down through the hall and the vaulting between. And then as we work from the basement up into the main level of the courthouse, interestingly enough, you get up into the courthouse and you can see, again, the Roman style stone arches, as well as even the vaulting is stone up above. So this is not Guastavino's work. His work is kind of limited to the basement. What's fascinating about this building, for those that might not know the history of the building, but at one point the street out front of the building was lowered after the building had been built. And so by lowering the street, it caused this lower portion to become a new entry into the building because of the street being lowered. And so the main entry prior became almost like a piano nobile in more classical form. And so this lowering portion, this vaulting, then Guastavino's work came in later after the fact, after the building had been built. And so here we see an interesting case where the architect needed some way to support this building that was being undermined by the street being lowered. And so looking around came to rely on Guastavino having a reputation at this point of having this structural innovation from Spain of these tile vaults that could support this weight. And so this is the case that it's being used on this particular structure. This brings us to St. Boniface Catholic Church on, in the North Hills in 1926. We see really this is one of the best examples in town of Guastavino really in his purest form, reaching kind of the apex of his talents. In this case, we have what's referred to as a pendentive dome. We have a dome in the center here, with four arches around the perimeter that the dome sits atop. And so then these corners here are infill, what are referred to as pendentives. And this is becomes a quite complex structural element to suspend this dome on these lower arches and bringing them down, as you can see here, to points in the corners. So all of this weight is being supported just on these four corners that stand almost up on legs of a table, if you could imagine. And then from these arches on the sides here, we have a more traditional barrel type vault that's going off perpendicularly, that heads off in the four directions. In addition to that, within the dome itself, we have multiple openings around the perimeter, which also just further increasingly complicates structurally the build. See, as we look down here from below, you can see those openings around the dome. You can see the barrel vaults continuing out in the main axis here down through the church on the right. And then at the end of the church here on the left, a half dome receiving this as well within this arch. So quite a complex structure, and really shows the mastery of Guastavino in not only handling the structure, but also even the decorative elements throughout. The infill herringbone that we've been looking at, but also just the detailing up inside here in a decorative fashion on all the ribbing, as well as even the ornamentation here around the perimeter of the dome. And as we look back down through the nave of the church, you can see again a repeating of these ribs working down through with the side clerestories openings, and then the infill barrel vaults between them. You can also see from this view here the where the these vaults come down to support atop these columns. And then the side aisles, again, here infill with the vaulting as well. This in this case, these ribs are plastered over, but I suspect from the shallow nature of the curvature that that's again this the layering of the ribs that we find elsewhere through the structure. This is the William Penn Hotel. 1928. We see in between the wings here coming out, we see so this bridge structure that we found at CMU, a similar type structure here, in this case supporting the outside exterior wall of the main hotel here proper. Getting a little bit closer, you can see his herringbone pattern with the ribs between supporting. This brings us to the Allegheny General Hospital on the north side. This was in 1929. this was getting into a more of an Art Deco style structure in design. There's influences here of several different styles, but this kind of time period in the 1920s, that Art Deco was very popular, and so we see in this particular case, we see Guastafino getting into these decorative tiles to kind of address that demand or that request by architects for that type of detailing. And so within this vault here, we can see, much like we saw with the church prior, St. Boniface, we can see his handling of these vaults with ease at this point. Even the ribs here, you can see this profile here is quite sophisticated, where he's combining this barrel shape with the traverse angle here. But as we get in a little bit closer, along the ribs, he's outlining these here with these decorative pieces to showcase and create this very ornamental style, decorative style. As we get in a little bit closer, you can see they're actually reflective, the glass tiles in this case, but also again, triangular shape, various forms, that these elongated pieces here, and then even the infills in the various types of shades of white that's being used in the again the infill pieces that with the striations, but also the ribs handled in a different texture, just for the ornamentation. And so at this time period in the 20s, you can see that his factory that was producing these tiles back in the teens that we saw on CMU's campus is becoming much more sophisticated in being able to handle different types of glazing, different types of materials, clays, in this case, even with working with glass in the firings. And that brings us also downtown to the Bell Telephone Company building, to really probably his best example in town in Pittsburgh here of a really decorative tile. This is an arcade on the exterior of the building at the Bell Tower or the Bell Telephone building. And this arcade carries down through. Again, you see the traditional Spanish low vault. We get in a little bit closer. We see some of the same type detailing that we saw just a minute ago on the hospital, where the ribs are lined on the perimeter with a decorative tile here, in this case, a dark green. But also the field tile here is no longer just the terracotta. He's actually now ornamenting that with color as well. And also a very sophisticated modeling of color. We're seeing a half dozen different colors here, very subtle variations in tone, just to create this modeling effect. Some of this is created as a result of the firing. When you would fire, you might get different tiles and different glazes, depending on how the glaze is applied, firing at different finishes. But nevertheless, you can see in the hues here, the greens and the yellows, and the tans were intentional to have this very decorative, ornamental finish. You can see closer up here, you can see the reflective quality of the glaze. Again, handling the light to bring light, natural light inside to this arcade to keep it from feeling dark. But also, again, the modeling of the colors. And even within the rib pieces here, you see the variation in the glaze as well, in the greens and the hues across each individual tile, which is just adding to his palette of tools and tricks that he can use for decorating a surface. Quite stunning. Also, I'll just point out here, since we're here, you can see this inside corner. Again, these tiles being laid up in layers, You can see this being a right angled. This arcade itself is rectilinear, and so in the corner it's a right angle, 90 degree angle. This tile being a right angle piece, a rectilinear tile lays in to where you can lay the cement that's binding the tile and holding it in place. Is on this face and on this edge and this edge of the tile, so the tile can be laid in on two sides to hold it in place while the mortar sets up. And then once that sets up, they lay a second tile in alongside it. And so here you have again, you have the tile along the edge on this side, but then also now you have this edge of a tile that was just laid prior to it that it can lay against. And so a similar thing, you got this small corner here. They have a small piece of tile that's laid in, sets into this corner. And so this technique that Guastavino was using, which is a Spanish technique that predated Guastavino, but that he was bringing to the United States, hadn't been used before in the United States. This was new to the architects and builders in this country at the time. And so he was bringing this technique, and this enabled him. They would work out of the corners. The corners were really the trick. And so you work out of the corners and you work your way out. And so once these perimeters were laid in, same thing with the ribs, then the ribs are then filled in with a vault between in this herringbone. And the herringbone is the exact same concept. Each tile is laid in. So this piece, for example, is laid in. The next one that goes in alongside it, it can adhere to two sides, these two sides alongside it. So once this one's in, this third piece goes in and now has two sides to lay against. And so that continues to work its way out. And then in addition to horizontally, once that first layer is laid, then a second layer is laid on top of that, and then a subsequent third layer in some cases, and that creates that multiple layer vault that we've been seeing here tonight. This brings us to Hines Memorial Chapel on Pitt's campus. And we can see here in this case a Gothic structure, Gothic vaults in shape, a little bit different from the Roman true circles. But even with the Gothic, you can see the tiles here laid in the vaults. The ribs themselves are stone and very much in Gothic fashion. In a true Gothic, French Gothic cathedral, the vaults would also be stone. But here in this case, they're infilling it with the Spanish tile, clay tiles. So this also is an innovation of the technique, is that it could adapt to multiple architectural styles, whether it's Roman, Gothic, Spanish, of course. It could adhere to all of these various types of geometric profiles. Another view here of the memorial ceiling. Then that brings us to the Cathedral Learning right next door on Pitt's campus. This is in 1936. And by this time in the 30s, steel was becoming more and more prevalent in construction. And so we see here on the left-hand side this image, we see the steel structure that is being erected for the cathedral itself, supporting the cathedral. And so as a result of steel and also concrete, reinforced concrete was also in this time period becoming much more prevalent in structures. The demand for Guastavino's structural tiles was waning. And this was as a result of these new materials that lended various types of attributes that was sought out by these architects of the time, seen as more of a modern type building material, a new material, steel, concrete, glass, coming online. And so Guastavino in his innovative fashion, found ways to also create still some demand for his tiles. And so in this case, we see on the interior of the main ground level here, again, Gothic in style in the vaulting. But in this case, we see these tiles that were a patented tile of a new type of process that he used with the clay, to where it was fired to have pockets of air within the tiles themselves, little cavities, almost like Swiss cheese, if you could imagine. And this was a brand that he titled Acoustolith Tiles. And so we're seeing examples here in the cathedral of these tiles, patented tiles that he came out with at this time period. And these tiles, because they had these little nooks and crannies in the surface pockets, enabled it to capture sound, and it made it difficult for sound to reverberate off of a smooth surface. It would almost kind of trap the sound as it was passing over the surface. And this would enable the interior. One of the things that was being found with the stone face vaults that you traditionally would have in a cathedral surface is very very loud acoustically, makes a very loud space and active dynamic space acoustically. And so the need or the desire to try and to soften or quiet that space in a church setting, or in this case here, an academic setting for studying, it was of desire. And so this acoustical tile was a way of doing this. And so you can see here, even with the ribs again being laid up in stone, they're filled in with this acoustic tile in between. And so for those of you that have been in this building, which I'm sure most of you have, you can appreciate the sound quality within there. One thing that's interesting is if you go to the spiral stairs that work their way up from this main level here up to the upper floors, within those small spiral stairs, you can get closer to the ceiling to where you can get a better sense of what that acoustical tile looks like. It also feels different than a true terracotta tile. And also you can see perceptibly when you walk through those stair halls, as you walk up through, how much quieter it becomes as you pass into those spaces. The deadening of the sound is palpable. And then finally, that brings us to our last structure, Guastavino structure here in Pittsburgh. This was in 1942. In 1942, 1934, East Liberty Presbyterian Church, he did some work on the tiling in the main vaults of the church, structural tiles. His tiles were not used for the decorative ornament, but they were used to support the vaults, the main vaults in the church. But I bring you here to this side chapel, what's called the Trinity Chapel, off of one of the wings, which is the crypt that we're seeing here, where Richard Mellon was laid, as well as his wife Jenny, and this crypt was put in 1942. So it was a little bit of time after the vaulting work that Guastavino was doing on the church proper. But what's interesting about this crypt, which is why I wanted to bring this here, is not only is it the last Guastavino tile that's laid in Pittsburgh in 42, but you can see here in the architectural drawings, a section through the little chapel here, you can see the two vaults here on the right and the left, where their bodies are buried. But then up at the top here, as we work our way up, you see, again, the French Gothic style arch that we're seeing here with the carved, and you can see even the notation on the drawings here, the carved stone, the detailing in all of this here. But what's interesting is up above this vault, Up above the arch here, you see again the trademark low profile Spanish vault that's happening here. And at this time, Guastavino, the melons had become had worked with the melons in various capacities on CMU's campus and at East Liberty here and various other places. And so this chapel was a scenario where they came in to create this chapel and to really showcase, give an opportunity for Guastavino to showcase his work on the finished surface here of the vaults themselves, which we're not going to find in the church proper, but on this little side piece. And so, with that, we'll open it up for any questions that you might have. Sure. Right. So that's it's a technique they where it's an interesting thing where let me see if I can pull back to a picture here. What's fascinating is that the way most of these vaults traditionally would be 2 to 3 layers thick, and that would depend on the 2 to 3 layers would depend on how the finished surface that we're seeing here on the underside would be handled. So in this case, where we're having a decorative tile on the underside that's going to be the finished surface, that tile is actually not laid first when they actually lay the vault. The layer in between that's sandwiched by the top layer and the bottom layer, that layer actually gets laid first. And when that's laid, it's laid with a quick setting plaster. It's like a it's a, actually a plaster of Paris is the type of plaster that's used. And that's a very quick setting plaster, sets up within about 10 to 15 minutes. And so those first tiles that are laid, if you remember from what I was just showing you, where they're laid on two sides, adhered with that plaster of Paris, that lays in, and then once that sets up 10 to 15 minutes later, it's strong enough to where it can support the layer on top, the weight of the tile that's coming on top. And so then that layer on top then would then sandwich on top of the layer that the first layer that was laid. The sandwiching between those is done with a Portland cement. And a Portland cement doesn't set up as quickly as a plaster of Paris. It takes hours for Portland cement to set up, and then actually days for it to cure structurally. But because the first layer was laid, it supports the weight of the tile while that Portland cement is curing and drying. And so that upper layer then goes in, and then once that cures after a day or two, you now have 2 layers that are at this point structurally sound to where it could support the structural loading that's going on to this vault. And so in this case, you see cases of structures where it just literally is just the 2 layers of tile. That's the case with the Buell Planetarium on the north side at the Children's Museum, which is also one of the structures we didn't see here tonight, but I'll be covering this later this year. That vault structurally is just literally just 2 layers at the highest point. Just 2 inches thick. It's quite remarkable for the span that it has. But in any event, once those two are in place, then the third layer comes in on the underside, and that's then adhered to the underside. And so that's the tile that we're seeing here on the underside of this vault. And so this decorative tile is then laid in. It's adhered to the that middle tile layer, and then the joints. The grout joints that you're asking about here, those would then be once the tiles would be placed in, the gap that's between those tiles that's left. If anyone that's laid tile is familiar with how you lay a tile and you leave a gap for the mortar to fill in between the mortar joint. And so that gap then would be filled in with the mortar. And this, in this case, he would have a special type of trowel that would score along the surface this raised kind of grout. And this was kind of like a patent, or kind of a trade secret patented technique that he would use. And you can see here, when you get in a little bit closer, you can see this little bit of, you can see also here down in the left-hand corner, you can see marks, indications here where they're pulling the trowel across here and they stop. And you can see that that leaves maybe a little bit of grout that's kind of like spilling out from maybe up against this that was scored prior to it. You know, so maybe this one went in first and this one came to it. And this edge here wasn't necessarily cleaned up like this edge here is. So this is maybe a little bit of sloppy work, you could imagine, relatively speaking. But those are kind of the indications that kind of give you the clues as to how this was laid in. And so that would be not only a specialty tool that they would use, but also would become a signature. So that way, architects, when they would see these structures, they would immediately recognize this as Guastavino's work. This would become much like the herringbone pattern and much like the striations that we see in the tile. This raised grout that came along at that time period was a signature piece that he would want then going forward to kind of showcase, just to kind of leave his mark, so that way it was almost kind of a calling card to get future work. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, that's an absolutely beautiful building. I didn't show it here tonight, but I will show it this summer in the class. The stained glass in that building is phenomenal. In my opinion, it's the best stained glass in Pittsburgh. It's a very contemporary style stained glass. It's not a traditional stained glass that we're familiar with, like a Tiffany glass that you might find on the north side in some of the other locations around town. But that stained glass in that particular structure is phenomenal. And hopefully that building will, I know there's efforts right now to try to save it and restore it. And they're trying to bring some various functions in to kind of create the funding to make that happen. And hopefully they'll be successful at it. Yeah, that's a great question. So the obviously the skill set needs to the as I was describing in the lecture, the technique that's being used, the sequencing, the way this is all done is all an acquired skill. And so when Guastavino came over with his son, literally it was just the two of them, as well as his housekeeper, that came over to the United States, but they subsequently had to train the local labor, the local tile setters and stone masons that they would be employing on this work, had to train them in the techniques. And all these techniques were patented techniques. He was very careful to kind of guard his techniques, and he actually went after other contractors that used the same technique once they learned how to do it. He went after them with suits to try to prevent them from building in this fashion, so that way he could kind of corner the market on this. And we see, as we'll see kind of in the lecture later this year, this is throughout the country, some of the greatest buildings that you might be familiar with, landmark buildings, all have this tile technique that's used. And so he would have... multiple projects in the dozens going on simultaneously in multiple cities around the country. And so he had many, many different labor forces that he had to manage to carry this stuff out. And so it got to the point where he and his son would just go around from site to site and just kind of oversee as opposed to actually doing the work. But the skill set definitely would have to be trained, and that was something that was closely guarded. So it's interesting. The only time that's really happening today is when they're trying to restore one of his vaults in a restoration or preservation. There's actually one of those that's happening right now in Pittsburgh. On the north side, the Pittsburgh Athletic Club has a pool that was tiled much the same way as the Mellon Residence. In fact, the Mellon Residence was a result of the Pittsburgh Athletic Club. Once Miss Mellon saw the club and she wanted it for herself, Mr. Mellon obliged her with putting in a pool into their house, so she wouldn't have to go to the club. But that tile itself was in disrepair. That building is currently last year or so. It might be complete by now. I haven't been down that way since. But about a year and a half ago, I was through that building and they were restoring it, and they were peeling back layers that were over top of the tile, and they were going to quite great lengths to clean up the tile below it, to kind of then leave that as the finish for the finished space that they're going to use now, much the same way that the Mellon pool was done with the academic setting. But in any event, some of those tiles were found damaged, had to be restored and repaired. And so that's kind of where that comes in today, as mostly that. There's not really people that are laying this tile up as a first pass. It's more restoration work. Unfortunately, at the time that this was done, it was a very inexpensive way to build because of the lack of scaffolding and various attributes. But now, because masonry work has become a very skilled trade, very costly labor has driven the price up to where it's much cheaper to do other forms of structural work, and so the demand for it is not there, just mostly for cost purposes. That's a good question. I don't know specifically an answer to that question. I'd have to do a little bit more research in 42 to that point. It's interesting to note that Pittsburgh was building quite a few structures, not quite a few, but a handful of structures at that time period. And that really speaks to the strength of Pittsburgh as far as the money that was here, as well as the development that was happening, even during that time period. So that's a fascinating question. The tile holds up very well, especially if it's glazed. The mortar joints is really the weak point, because that is soluble and can break down. And so really the mortar joints is really the only portions that need a whole lot of attention over time. But fortunately, with the vaulting, they're all undercover. They're not out exposed to direct rain. You get the humidity and you get the temperature swings, which also have an impact. The changing temperatures, like the freezing temperatures we have right now, has impacts on the tiles as far as the expansion contraction that you get, the movement. But nevertheless, it does hold up pretty well. And it's the joinery that really needs most of the work. There's an interesting photo that I'll share later this year. Also in the Cathedral Learning, there's a crack. There's some settlement that's going on in the cathedral, and there's some cracks that are showing up, structural cracks where you can see movement in the structure, which I believe the school is looking into. But interestingly enough, the cracks, generally speaking, when you get a crack in any type of masonry work, the crack will follow through the joints, not down through the stone or the tile itself, because the joint is generally speaking the weak point that the crack will kind of follow. What's interesting about this particular crack at the Cathedral Learning is it's actually cracking through the tiles, and the joint themselves are not cracking, and so that kind of speaks to the structural quality of the mortar that they were using at the time was a very high grade structural mortar set, Portland cement, that was had a stronger tensile quality than the tile itself. And so as the stresses move through the structure, it goes to the weakest link, in this case the tile itself. But so that speaks to your question as far as the mortar generally holds up pretty well on the exterior, but over time, eventually it'll need touched up and repaired and replaced as the mortar breaks down. So relatively speaking, all the various types of methods that you could do to build a structure, whether it's stone, clay, steel, concrete, masonry, generally speaking, is the worst method you can use for earthquakes. Earthquakes are there's various types of earthquakes, as far as some that have movement that's rhythmic, almost like a wave pattern through the structure as the ground moves. Others are vibrational and just shake laterally back and forth. And so then you so as a result, various types of quakes, you get various types of movements, very erratic and sometimes unpredictable. And the movements in various directions just wreaks havoc on a structure. Modern day structures account for this by having various types of measures of counterweights and joints and flexible joints in the structures, steel structures, that type of thing. But one of the best strategies for an earthquake is to have a structure that's flexible, that moves with the earthquake and can take that movement and kind of deaden and dampen that movement out. A structure that's rigid and doesn't flex and doesn't move, that stress that's placed on it from an earthquake has to be relieved at some point. And so if it's rigid, it's going to cause the structure to crumble because it has to relieve that stress. And so with a masonry structure, they're very rigid. They're not made to flex. And so they're prone to earthquakes quite a bit. But that said, what's an interesting side note in the thousand plus structures that Guastavino built across the country over about a 70-year period, not one single structure has collapsed. They all are still standing today. The ones that have come down by choice. They haven't failed from a structural standpoint. Yeah, so the fireproof was also another innovation, patented innovation. That was one of his first patents. And ironically, his timing was perfect when he came to the States, because he arrived and he set up shop in New York and Boston, in both cities, within about a decade prior, had experienced a tragic fire that ripped through the city. Much like you might also be familiar with the Chicago Fire, which had great impacts on architectural designs. But these fires were at the front of mind of builders and architects. And so one of the things that he marketed with his technique was these structural clay tiles could withstand the fires, because of the fact that the tiles themselves are fired in a kiln. at great temperatures, much hotter than the what they would be exposed to in a building fire. So the tiles themselves would not break down, and the mortar as well, the same type thing. And so he went to great pains to demonstrate this. He would build up these mock vaults and then set them afire underneath and show that they could withstand not only the fire, but he would also load them up with sandbags and show that the structure of the vault would not be compromised in continuing to support the weight despite the fact that there would be a fire underneath. And this was quite impressive, as you can imagine, as a display. He would invite the media, try to get as much publicity as he could out of these events. Invite architects, builders to witness it. Because also another thing, which I'll get into more depth as well this summer, but the Guastavino marks a time period when there was a transition from the method of construction that was done with the trades or the guilds to a point when after Guastavino, as steel and concrete came into play, it became more of an engineering trade that would build these structures. And so much of the stuff prior to this period, it wasn't so much like it was calculated mathematically how these loads would be transferred and how these materials would function. It was more of a demonstration of building mock samples to show how they would hold up. And so this kind of demonstration is the way it had been done for thousands of years, and this is what Guastavino was familiar with, coming from that older generation. And so, so yes, the tiles did hold up to fire, and so then he patented them as fireproofing materials. And there's quite a few examples here in Pittsburgh that were used in that fashion as a fireproofing type finish material, and as well as holding up to the weather as the water as well, same type thing with the glazing. Well, I just submitted the proposal late, unfortunately. Sorry, I apologize for that. But the it was just submitted a couple days ago. I'm resubmitting it again this evening. And so I don't think the class has been set as far as which session and signing up. But yeah, maybe Anna, you could speak a little bit to that. His son was, I believe, 9 years old at the time. That's right. Yeah, he basically, which was also very traditional back in Europe at the time, at that age, he worked as an apprentice under his father, learning the techniques and the methods, and worked his way up. And then subsequently, then as his father kind of retired out of the practice, he didn't necessarily retire, but he took on fewer and fewer works himself, kind of like the projects that he was interested in working on, and his son took on the lion's share of the work. And interestingly enough, just a side note, since we're talking about Pittsburgh's structures here, all of the structures that we looked at here tonight, and all of them here in Pittsburgh, just by the dates alone, were done under the hand of his son, Guastavino Jr. Who took over the practice in the, I believe, in around 1907, 8, 9, in that time period. His son kind of took over the lion's share of the work all over the country, which would have included Pittsburgh at that time, right before, back in the 18, I think it was 95 or 96, actually it was 94, 1894, Guastavino Sr. went down to North Carolina to work on Vanderbilt's house. And that commission was quite large. And once he got down there, he fell in love with the location, decided to build a house for himself in the mountains down near that area, and subsequently did a few other projects in the region. But as a result of that, Senior, once he went down there in the late 90s and then into the turn of the century, he would still make trips back up north, looking over, certain projects that were significant that maybe he had an interest in seeing what his son was working on. But by and large, he didn't really manage those projects. And so most of the virtually all of the projects in Pittsburgh were done under Junior's hand. There might be some of the very first ones on Carnegie Mellon's campus might possibly have been overlooked by his father, but there really isn't any kind of documentation to kind of substantiate that. But I suspect because they were commissions with Mellon and what he saw as the potential that could come out of that, which obviously did with Mellon's work, I could see him taking a personal approach to wanting to, at least in the first project or two, like Porter Hall, that type of thing, being involved in that. Yeah, no, I'll go into definitely more depth in that in the summer with that. He did leave Spain under scandal. His marriage broke up over affairs that he was having, and that was part of the reason why he left. Also at the time in at the you know in the 19th cent late 19th century, the United States was one of the busiest places around the world as far as construction. So there was a real opportunity over here to come. But nevertheless, I believe he never went back to Spain. His son, I think, made trips back later in life, but Senior, I don't think, ever made it back after he came over. It's Gua Stavino. Yep, absolutely. Thank you. I appreciate it. It was a pleasure to present it. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks. Absolutely. 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 Thank you. I look forward as well. Thank you.